From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, in Syria's civil war, some Alawites turn against the Alawite dictator. In Rome, reminders of the prominent role women played in the early Christian church. And in Spain, an ancient ritual makes a comeback, hunting wild boar on horseback. The Alawites of Syria were a poor, little-known minority. That is, until longtime dictator Hafez al-Assad, himself an Alawite, rose to power in 1970. His son, the current president, Bashar al-Assad, is now fighting to maintain that power in a country that has risen up against him. But NPR's Kelly McEvers recently met a group of Syrian Alawites in Cairo who say they are now willing to denounce the regime despite the risks.
The gathering in Cairo was much like other conferences hosted by the Syrian opposition. A flurry of activity in the hotel lobby, lots of late-night conversation, lots of cigarettes. But this one was different. This one was organized by a particular sect. The idea was to publicly urge Alawites inside Syria to abandon the Syrian regime, according to this statement read by one of the conference organizers. We call on our brothers in the Syrian regime, and especially the sons of our sect, not to raise your weapons against your own people, he said, to refuse to join the army. Alawites like these are not the norm. Most Alawites still support the Syrian government, whether tacitly or overtly. After the meetings and out by the hotel pool, this man, who only wanted to go by the name Aburin, says up until recently, Alawites who supported the regime could live in a bubble, pretending everything was okay, that the war wouldn't touch them. But now, he says, that's changing.
There are many funerals, more than you can even imagine. Before I came here, 3 days, I was at the funeral of my nephew. Adi Amru. He was 27. He was an officer with the army.
Aburin's nephew died while fighting in northern Syria at a government airbase that for months was a key battleground. Anti-government rebels finally took the base in January. Aburin's nephew's body was never returned. At the nephew's funeral, Aburin says the relatives who support the government down to their bones blamed the rebels for his death, but others cursed the government. The president lives in palaces, they said, while we live in graves. Aburin says he came to Cairo to represent these Alawites, the Alawites who oppose the Syrian government.
Is it dangerous for him to be here, though?
It's very dangerous, especially for my family inside. There is a big possibility that when I'll go back, I'll just go to prison.
Aburin had hoped that by coming out against the government, the opposition would offer him some kind of protection. But that didn't transpire. Burhan Galiun, a leading figure in the Syrian opposition, who comes from the Sunni majority, said it's simply not fair to give special privileges to one group.
No one can give me guarantees, and I cannot give guarantees to anyone.
But the Alawites say they are special, because the regime is basically holding them hostage. Even if they did want to defect, they say they'd have nowhere to go. Either the regime would catch them, or the opposition would punish them. One of the organizers of the Cairo gathering is a guy who prefers to go by the name Jamal. He says he's faced the opposition's hatred up close in the so-called liberated areas of northern Syria, where opposition and Islamist fighters hold swaths of territory.
There was one instance where I was in a town. There was a banner. It is forbidden for Alawites and dogs to enter. And I asked, since I'm an Alawite dog, can I take a picture with this banner? And I did.
Jamal says tensions between the Alawites and the Sunnis go way back. That's why it was so surprising for many Syrians to see Alawites among the early protesters against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Jamal says, back in 2011.
There was a huge welcoming. We were embraced. We were warmly welcomed. Even people were excited. But then it all changed. We even became personas non grata. Now we have cases of killings based on your sectarian identity.
And cases of kidnappings, he says. Jamal says the conference in Cairo was a step in the right direction, but it needs to go much further to stave off what he says could be widespread sectarian violence. This uprising against the government will not be killed by airstrikes and Scud missiles, Jamal says, referring to the weapons used by the regime. It will be killed by sectarianism. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
The newly elected Pope has made clear he wants to focus attention on the poor and the marginalized, and that has instilled great hope among many Catholic women. They hope this papacy will promote a greater role for them in the Church. A group of American nuns and Catholic women recently made a pilgrimage to Rome to make their feelings heard. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli joined them as they visited sites that show women taking on leadership roles in early Christianity.
Yes. And the main north-south road, the Cardo, went that way. And the Civic Basilica was over there.
Sister Carolyn Osick, a scholar of the role of women in early Christianity, is guiding the pilgrims through Ostia, the ancient port city of Rome. These excavations help illustrate how people lived in the early centuries of the first millennium, when worship was still relegated mostly to private homes. Ostia is the final stop on these American women's pilgrimage as they honor the many women who helped spread the faith at the dawn of Christianity. The pilgrims gather together on the steps of the old Roman theater and sing a prayer song in which God is evoked in a feminine metaphor.
Come, Sophia, holy wisdom, gateway to eternity. Sacred source of all that is from long before earth came to be.
Throughout the Mediterranean, inscriptions and images are found on tombstones, frescoes, and mosaics that provide compelling evidence that women held leadership and ministerial roles in the early church, roles identical to those held by men as prophets, priests, and deacons. These American pilgrims have visited catacombs, where frescoes show women being clothed in priestly vestments and celebrating the Eucharist.
So certainly in the first two centuries, we see women, at least some parts of the early communities, holding co-equal roles with men.
Sister Chris Schenk is executive director of the Catholic group Future Church, which organized the pilgrimage. She says everything changed after the year 313 when women were pushed out of the public arena and lost their roles as office holders.
After Constantine made Christianity legal, worship moved from the house church into the basileia, the basilicas, and it became a public space where women's leadership was not as accepted because of the cultural norms of the time. And so around that time, you see more and more suppression of women in leadership roles.
These pilgrims have also come to this ancient site to offer their individual prayers.
We pray.
Jesus, prophet with wisdom, lead and guide us.
That all women may find their voice and realize its value.
Jesus, prophet.
Sister Schenk.
Part of the power of our pilgrimage is that women's experience is validated not only in seeing women leaders in church archaeology, but it's also validated in prayer. And often women do not experience that.
The pilgrimage ended with an encounter at the Vatican, where some 25,000 signed postcards and open letters were handed over, asking church officials to help resolve the growing problem of the worldwide shortage of priests by allowing celibacy for men to be optional and by letting women once again be deacons. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
This network sends foreign correspondents abroad to bring you the latest news of wars, coups, protests, and the economy. But often, a better way to learn about a changing world is to sample the local cuisine. That's what our correspondent Anthony Kuhn did in the capital of Indonesia. In that part of the world, vegetarian cultures are centuries old, built around foods like the Indonesian soybean cake called tempeh.
Tempeh is one of the most versatile foods, and there's an almost endless variety of ways you can cook it. I myself actually prefer one of the simplest, which is just to coat it in spices and pan-fry it. First, I'm going to take a stone mortar and pestle and grind up some coriander seeds and some garlic and salt. Then I just take the sliced pieces of tempeh and dip them in the spices and then pan-fry them until they're golden brown. I'm aware, of course, that in the U.S., tempeh has a reputation as hippie food. But here in Indonesia, and particularly on the island of Java, tempeh is so basic to the daily diet, you could just about call it meat and potatoes fare. Well, minus the meat, maybe. Tempeh is made using a unique process of fermentation, and I'm curious to see how that works. So I've come to a place locals call
Perkampungan Tempeh Indonesia.
Tempeh Village. It's a working-class neighborhood of simple low-rise homes. Our host is Mr. Handoko, who goes by just one name.
Oh, kalau saya Handoko.
He's the manager of this cooperative that provides roughly a third of Jakarta's tempeh.
We have 1,417 tempeh-making households here. The cooperative produces nearly 2 tons of tempeh a day.
Handoko says tempeh has been a part of the local culture for centuries.
You cannot get bored with tempeh. You can eat it every day. It doesn't cause high blood pressure for you. It doesn't increase your cholesterol. So it's very good.
First, Mr. Handoko takes us to see where they prepare the soybean. We've come to the communal kitchen where they prepare and boil the beans. It starts out with a bunch of barrels where they wash and then husk the soybeans. The villagers that are working here, stripped to the waist and sweating as they slosh the beans around in these huge tubs full of water next to these massive oil barrels with wood fires smoking underneath them. Mr. Handoko says the beans are then taken from the kitchen back to the individual families that will make them into cakes of tempeh.
Belum, ini ada mesin pemecahnya.
First, we mix the clean and split beans with some yeast, and then we pack them into cakes, and we put the cakes on these drying racks to ferment for 18 hours.
Handoko shows us a small brick of cassava starch. This is used to make the mold or fungus that causes the beans to ferment. Let's check it out. No particular smell to it, but this is what makes the beans stick together. When I eat the tempeh, I don't believe I taste this. You taste the smoky, nutty, mushroomy, meaty taste of the tempeh. Handoko says the fermentation is what makes tempeh so healthy and allows you to digest all those high-protein soybeans without ballooning up with gas. Javanese have been eating it for centuries. Mr. Handoko says he was raised on it.
We have to eat tempeh every day because if you don't, as if you don't eat meat that day.
I'm hooked on it myself, you know.
Yeah. Perorangan.
Handoko says his daughter makes the tempeh into crispy snacks, which she sells over the internet. And he has sky-high expectations for his village's product.
I think that with government support, in 20 years' time, tempeh will conquer the world.
Global domination by cakes of fermented soybeans in 2 decades' time? Then again, a few decades back, who would have guessed that raw fish, wasabi, and rice balls would catch on in the U.S.? Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Jakarta.
Coming up, Egypt's government runs low on cash. Spaniards hunt wild boar the way the Romans did. And the Rolling Stones return to Hyde Park 44 years after they made history there. Two years after the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, Egypt is in a deep economic crisis. The government is running out of funds needed to purchase crucial imports like wheat and fuel. Both are heavily subsidized. But with foreign currency reserves at record low, Egypt desperately needs an infusion of cash. This added urgency to a visit by a delegation from the International Monetary Fund. They went to Cairo this week to continue negotiations on a $4.8 billion loan. NPR's Leila Fadel sent this report.
It's just after 3 p.m. and workers unload cooking gas canisters at this government distribution center. The government has just doubled the price for each canister as part of an energy reform package needed to satisfy the conditions of the IMF loan. But for Musa Dedeb, it's a disaster. The back of his bicycle is loaded with six canisters he will sell for a minuscule profit. He will make less than 30 cents for each canister, and that means less food for his four children. Raising the prices will get us this loan, he says, but when they raise the prices on the poor, how do we live? How do we eat? It is a conundrum. Egypt's foreign reserves have dwindled to about $13.5 billion from $36 billion before the 2011 revolution here. The government is already dealing with a huge budget deficit, and about a quarter of its spending goes to subsidies for fuel and wheat. Soon, the government may not be able to afford to import these commodities. But lifting the subsidies could lead to even broader unrest in a country where the population is reeling after more than 2 years of political upheaval, economic downturns, and sporadic violence. Mustafa Basyuni is an economist at the Signet Institute in Egypt.
Egypt is an economic crisis right now that is driven mostly by very low levels of economic growth.
Basyuni says that the subsidies distort the market and are the major reason for the deficit. The government's reserves will only last for another 3 months, if that, he says. But lifting subsidies on cooking gas is not the answer, he says. It is a very small savings on a commodity the poor of Egypt need, while other subsidies that benefit the well-off are left untouched.
The government is directly channeling the full effect of the subsidy removal to the poorest segments of society. This is not only fiscally ineffective, but morally inconsistent.
Meanwhile, the cost of food is soaring. For example, a chicken has gone from about $3 in 2012 to $6 this year. The price of rice is 28% higher, and the cost of bottled water has doubled. And because of the fuel shortages, there are repeated power outages in different parts of Cairo, and the situation is expected to get much worse during the blistering summer months. Getting the IMF loan, Basyuni says, would serve as an international endorsement that it's still okay for foreign companies and governments to invest in Egypt. At Hamdi Fawzi Hassan's bakery, he makes government-subsidized bread and sells it for the equivalent of a penny a loaf. If the government cancels the subsidies, he says, the poor won't have bread. Across town, an Egyptian housewife picks through the vegetables at an open-air market. Hala Sadiq rarely buys produce anymore. She can't afford it. People here say if the government can't fix the situation, the next revolt will be led by the hungry. Leila Fadel, NPR News, Cairo.
In Spain, an ancient ritual is making a comeback, the practice of hunting wild boar on horseback. And the Spanish don't use guns, they use spears. The sport goes back to Roman times and was recently approved under Spanish hunting regulations. Reporter Lauren Freyer rode along on one wild boar hunt. A warning, some listeners may find parts of this story disturbing.
Just a 20-minute drive from Spain's capital and you're in the Dehesa, oak woodlands where wild boar, deer, and mountain goats still roam. Madrid skyscrapers are on the horizon, but here ancient traditions still reign. A hunting party prays in unison.
Viva España!
Viva el rey!
Before mounting horses and riding off in search of wild boar. This landscape, parts of which are a UN biosphere reserve, has gradually emptied as Spaniards migrate to cities for jobs. Among those left is Ramiro Mora, whose family established this ranch centuries ago.
For thousands of years, the only way to get a boar was to chase it with a horse. There was no other weapon. This has been taking place for 2,000 years.
Often hunters chase a single boar all day. And often the animal gets away. This is not an efficient way to hunt. But Mora says guns, whatever you think of them, sometimes make it just too easy.
From the shotguns to the rifles, and from the rifles to the automatic rifles. And where will we keep going? How are you not going to try to protect the ancient ways of hunting when there's no limit to the capability of mankind to make more sophisticated weapons?
It takes expert riders to maneuver and finally corner a wild boar, then stab him with the long spears they've managed to lug along while galloping across steep terrain. In this case, the boar uses his tusks to try to attack one of the horses and then cries out as a spear pierces his heart. The animal is then hauled away to be cooked for dinner or exported to Germany, the number one destination for wild boar meat from Spain. Despite a growing animal rights movement in Spain and the recent ban on bullfighting in Catalonia, there's been no uproar over this sport, which is officially known as pig sticking.
It's something that hasn't got a lot of publicity, and it's something I think most Spanish citizens are not aware of. If they were, I am sure that a great percentage of them would be against this kind of cruel sport.
Sharon Nunez is a spokeswoman for the group Animal Equality. She hadn't heard of pig sticking either until it was recently added to hunting regulations. And while she says every effort should be made to uphold traditions, there's a limit.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same case with bullfighting. I mean, a tradition shouldn't stay or shouldn't remain if it's cruel and it means suffering and death to an innocent creature.
But where some see cruelty, others see beauty. Our hunting party includes a poet and a painter.
The adrenaline, the emotion is beautiful. You're not stalking behind an animal.
Pig sticking is like Dutch heaven.
Pig sticking has been around since Roman times, and perhaps even before that. Prehistoric cave paintings in Spain depict primitive man on horseback chasing wild boar with spears. It was also popular in colonial India. But the sport's resurgence here poses a dilemma for modern Spain, balancing rural traditions against the progressive society it's quickly become.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to reconcile these traditions.
José Manuel Calvo is the opinion editor at El País newspaper.
We try to make a distinction between the roots of a culture and customs in the rural world and the brutality and things that we, in the 21st century, we can't let go on.
Spain is still trying to negotiate its new identity. In the past 40 years, the country has changed from a military dictatorship to a democracy. Millions have abandoned rural life for cities. Wildfires ravage that empty land each summer. And now less than 20% of Spaniards live in rural areas.
To me, the thing that makes me more sad, and it's my biggest battle.
Jaime Patiño, one of the hunters on our trip, wears his grandfather's leather chaps and boots and a 19th century suit jacket to go riding.
We are the people that really protect the nature, and we are passionate of the countryside. And after that, you know, we are hunters and all that. But first of all, we are country people. We've been centuries doing this. The properties have been a long time in our families, and we pretend to continue in this way.
He's likely to be able to do so. Spain's cash-strapped government is selling off some public land to be converted into private hunting reserves. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
If you live in London and have any measure of cultural capital, You've probably heard that tickets went on sale this week for a concert billed as the music event of the summer. In July, the Rolling Stones will play Hyde Park for the first time since 1969. As NPR's Philip Reeves reports, the band's last concert there turned out to be a defining moment in musical history.
Those there on that day in Hyde Park for that gig on July the 5th, 1969, won't ever forget it. Mick Jagger hasn't.
It was a kind of strange, you know, it was a free concert. Brian Jones, who was a founding member of the band, had very recently died.
Brian Jones died just 2 days earlier. Jones was a brilliant musician, undone by drugs and alcohol. A few weeks before, he and the Stones had parted company. Stones superstar Keith Richards says the band felt they should go ahead with that concert despite Jones's death.
It was like, well, we got to go on. I mean, all these people are coming. It's one of those old showbiz things. The show must go on.
Hyde Park was swamped as never before. A quarter of a million people gathered there, drenched by sunshine and marijuana smoke.
It was actually the sort of high water mark of the hippie sensibility, because it really was love and peace.
Philip Norman has written highly acclaimed books about the Stones, including a new biography of Jagger. He was in London that day.
There was a sense, yes, of doing a quasi-religious gathering in memory of Brian Jones, who still had a huge fan base, but it quickly turned into a showcase for Mick Jagger.
Jagger transfixed the crowd the moment he walked out. Philip Norman again.
Mick was wearing this extraordinary white fluffy garment which looked like a little girl's party dress. It actually was a suit. It had really been made for Sammy Davis Jr. and Mick had borrowed it.
Jagger began by remembering Jones.
OK, now listen. Now will you just cool it just for a minute? Because I really would like to say something for Brian.
Despite interruptions, Jagger persisted.
Just before we start, and I really hope, if you do, I really appreciate it, if Brian could just say a few words what I think I feel about Brian, and I'm sure you do, and what we feel about him just going when we didn't expect him to, OK?
Those few words were from Adonais by Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Peace, peace. He is not dead. He does not sleep. He has awakened from the dreams of life.
Lots of white butterflies were released at the end of the poem. They'd been kept in these cardboard cartons, and many of them had died, and not many actually made it to flutter away. And there'd been long negotiations with the local authority that these had not got to be male butterflies, they had to be female butterflies, because males would devastate the gardens around.
We decay like corpses in the charnel. Fear and grief convulse us and consume us day by day, and cold hopes swarm like worms within our living clay.
Then the Stones played one of Jones's favourites and returned to doing what the Stones do.
It was difficult because, I mean, you're a band and it's the first go-round with a new guy. On top of that, it's one of the biggest shows you've ever done. You make the sign of the cross and keep your fingers crossed, you know, and hope for the best.
Keith Richards later said they played abysmally that day. They were adjusting to their new guitarist, Mick Taylor. This July's Hyde Park concert by the Stones will be different. This time we must pay for tickets. Crowd numbers are restricted to 65,000. But don't rule out the return of that white dress. Mick Jagger hasn't.
I tend to choose my dresses at the last minute, so I don't know what I'm going to do about that. I can still get into it.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.